Osiris.
Hey, this is Brendan from Umphrey's McGee. This podcast is part of the Osiris podcast family. Osiris is a growing community of music and culture podcasts connecting music fans with conversation, commentary, and of course, lots of music. Osiris works in partnership with Relics Magazine.
We are here with Dolph Ramsor, who you may know is the sponsor of our podcast, the original sponsor of our podcast, the godfather of North Carolina music.
Dolph being a sponsor of our show literally helps us keep the lights on, keeps batteries in the Zoom recorder, keeps the microphone cables working. Dolph, we appreciate all your support over the past year.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be a part of it.
We've been running an ad for the Ruin Brothers, which is one of the new albums that came out that you guys put out, but was produced by Rick Rubin, correct?
Correct. Correct.
I texted Dolph after like the second time we ran it and told him that I've never seen a more effective advertisement because it worked on my entire family. Because after I heard that ad on my own podcast a couple times when I was editing it, my wife listens to the Ruin Brothers all the time now, and I've listened to that album several times. It worked on us, man.
Well, that's great to know. That's great. And they're such talented guys, and they're sweet fellas as well. They're from the north of England, Scunthorpe, which is a very working class area, but they're really good guys.
That's right. So check out the Ruin Brothers album and all the other albums and the bands on Ramsor Records. You can go to ramsorrecords.com. And you can, if you're interested in any of the albums there, you can enter the promo code HISTORY and get 10% off. So go do it. Show Dolph some love, and we're thankful for him.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. 2018 saw tremendous growth in the cannabis industry in the United States as well as around the world. Kush Company Holdings is leading the way. It's a publicly traded company under the ticker KSHB and the parent to innovative cannabis industry leaders such as Kush Supply Company, Kush Energy, The Hybrid Creative, and Coletto Packaging Solutions. Kush Company Holdings has now sold more than 1 billion units and sells to more than 5,000 legally operated medical and adult use dispensaries, growers, and producers across North America, South America, and Europe. For more information about Kush Company Holdings, please visit kushco.com/podcast. That's kushco.com/podcast. That's kushco.com/podcast to learn more. I'm Bob Crawford.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now, first of 2019. Bob, how you feeling?
I feel pretty good. Do you realize that by May, we'll be into our third year?
Bob, is going to be our tri-anniversary.
Yeah, pretty amazing. 3 years of putting up with this crap. 3 years of something that we just did for fun, kind of to get started, didn't know where it was going, and it has taken on a life of its own. So, as always, thank you to our loyal patrons and our loyal listeners.
Yes, that's right. This is crazy. Like, this is, Bob and I both were at the Press On fundraiser that Tanya Marsh put together in Charlotte, which was amazing. And seeing so many of you guys and meeting you guys in person was just great. And yeah, I can't believe it's 2019 and we're doing it.
Yes. Tanya Marsh, a gentleman named Dan Platt, Matt Williams, they got together and created this benefit for the pediatric cancer charity that my wife and my family and I are a part of. It's called the Press On Fund. It's our family and two other pediatric cancer families. And we take in donations from people like you, and then we give money to out-of-the-box treatments for pediatric cancer diseases. We look for less toxic treatments, and we're out there. We're trying to seek higher survival rates and hopefully one day some cures. So thank you to them and the great David Childers for playing this event. But it was raised about, I guess, maybe a little over $7,000 in 2 days. So everyone who was a part of that, thank you so much.
Yeah, it was really great to see. Meet so many of you guys. I mean, obviously you guys know Bob better than me, so it was great to meet you guys and just see how you all came together around something amazing that just, I don't know, it kind of humbled me a bit to see so many people doing good things. In Road to Now news, this is our first episode. We took 2 weeks off, but don't worry, we've been recording episodes.
We do have a few ready to go. This is one of them. Our guest today will be Scott Wasserman. He's the president of the Bell Policy Center in Colorado. And the Bell Policy Center is a think tank that's whose mission is to ensure economic mobility for every citizen of the state of Colorado.
Right. And following on our interview with Jefferson Cowie, the last one we aired, we jumped on the question of the middle class. What's happened to the middle class? You know, why do we see this widening of wealth, you know, the gap between the rich and the poor? And how does it look, you know, at the local level in Denver, where the cost of living has skyrocketed much faster than the actual income that people have? How does that look in Denver? How does that compare with the national rates? And, you know, what can we do to try to ensure that you know, our kids will have the opportunity to work hard and be in the middle class?
And as we look towards the 2020 election cycle that we are now, I guess we're in the middle of it. As weird as that is, you know, will the middle class be an election issue?
I think it will be, because, Bob, aren't we all in the middle class?
Well, some of us think we are, right?
Yeah.
And this is something you're going to learn from Scott Wasserman. Who is middle class?
Yeah.
How do we define that?
It's such a part of who we think we are as a country, right? Even folks who live in worlds where they inherit all their wealth, there's something that just seems like not quintessentially American about the idea of inheriting something and not working for it. We all like to imagine ourselves as working for things, as being kind of on the same level, and as having the potential to move up. But the question is that last part true? And maybe the first part too.
Yeah, and it's that age-old question of, is it about cutting taxes and deregulation, right? Or, I mean, is that what sparks entrepreneurship? It sparks companies and industry to hire more people when they're paying less taxes to innovate? Or is it a matter of taxing at a higher rate people who make more money and offering services and opportunities to those at the lowest end of the economic spectrum?
Yeah, that's what we talked about with Scott. And so please enjoy our interview with Scott Wasserman of the Bell Policy Center.
Scott Wasserman, welcome to The Road to Now.
Great. Thank you very much for having me.
Scott, really excited to have you on the show. You run the Bell Policy Center, which is a nonprofit organization in Colorado that seeks to ensure economic mobility for every citizen of your state. And recently, or I'd say going back to last January, you wrote a brief op-ed in the Denver Post about what is the middle class and the misconceptions we may have about who is in the middle class. And after all, it is the most desired constituency for every politician, and it is the ambition of every member, every citizen of the country, to obtain middle class status. So, for our listeners, tell us about the middle class.
Sure. Well, as you say, it is this grand aspiration of every American to be middle class. And whether you're talking to poor people or you're talking to rich people, generally speaking, they want to be in the middle class, or they want to be perceived to be in the middle class. And this phrase, the middle class, is something that gets thrown around all the time. As you say, politicians are constantly talking about the middle class. And I think for me, I was just starting to get frustrated, because it seemed like there were no good definitions that I could find of what truly being middle class meant. And the reason it was important for me was I run this think tank in Colorado, where we're constantly talking about economic mobility, which is the idea that people are able to move up move up the economic ladder. And the idea being that we want as many middle class people as possible. And the only definition that I could find was a definition by the Pew Foundation. And the Pew Foundation defines middle class as 2/3 of to 2 times median income in your community. And so what that worked out to be was like, you know, somewhere between $65,000 to $150,000 a year. And I was looking at other data that suggested that just to be self-sufficient, self-sufficient meaning that you don't need public assistance to get by, you know, in Denver, if you have a family, it was going to be like $70,000 a year. And so, you know, for me, it was like, well, wait a minute. If being middle class means you make $65,000 a year, but actually you're just self-sufficient and just eking it out, what does it really mean to be middle class anyway? And so we did this study. We worked with the University of Colorado to analyze some data here in the state. And what we found is that really to be middle class, at least here in the state of Colorado, you got to make about $20,000 more than we thought to be sort of lower middle class. That's like $80,000 a year, all the way up to $160,000, $170,000 a year. So the whole band, but then, and I'll stop in a second, but like, you know, this whole, it's a bigger question than just money, right? Because it's like, what can you afford? What are the aspirational expenditures that we seek to have? And that means different things to different communities. I mean, you talk to some people, it's about the ability to give to charity. You talk to other people, you know, it's about sending your kids to summer camp. And so it's a really value-laden conversation about what it means to be middle class. And it conjures up a picture in our heads. And that's a big conversation. You know, when I talk to African Americans, they hate this conversation because they think about a white family and they think this is a conversation that completely excludes them. And it's just very value laden, and everybody's got that Norman Rockwell picture in their heads of what middle classness means.
Yes. It's one of those things where you have, there's the technical definition and then there's the social meaning of it. And so you have like, what would it mean to be in this middle class? Like, you got to define that, but like, it almost has these presumptions built into it. The middle class is something that we Americans like to talk about because we don't want people to think that we're in the lower class because that means we didn't work hard or something like that. But there's also like in America, kind of this, like, we don't also want to be rich because that implies that we, you know, that we're better than. It's this old kind of egalitarian strain in American society. It's really interesting to see the way that middle class as a definition, you know, statistical definition, I guess I could say it's a qualitative versus a quantitative notion of middle class, right?
Absolutely. We did this just to hammer that home. So we did a presentation on our report and we sent down a survey before the report and we just wanted respondents to tell us what they thought middle class meant from an income perspective. And it was all over the map. I mean, you had people who thought making $300,000 a year household income put them into the middle class when in fact it put them way above it. And then you had people who even looked at the lower end and said making $50,000 a year was middle class. Everybody wants to be in the middle class, even if they are something else.
And in the op-ed I read from last January, you said that 30% of middle class residents' income goes to education, and another 30% goes to rent if they can even afford a mortgage. That does not leave that money left over to deal with a flat tire or a busted hot water heater.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the statistics, like, so, you know, many of us have heard the statistic that says that, 60% of Americans don't have an extra $400, you know, to be able to handle an unexpected flat tire or something like that, right? So it's like, how is it possible? Let's just say for argument's sake, based on our study in Colorado, that 50% of Coloradans or 46% of Coloradans are middle class. How's it possible that 60% of Americans can't afford that you know, unexpected expense?
I mean, here's another thing that I feel like it gets left out of these statistics. Like, what is your debt? What did you pay to get there? And college loans are a big part of it. And it's like, you know, people are not able to buy houses in the same way. And you're looking at the fact that this Pew report that just came out on December 11th said that, like, of millennials, that, you know, in terms of their age group, they're making more than any generation of that age group in the last 50 years. And you're still seeing that it's harder and harder to buy home loans. And you can't talk about middle class unless you talk about what's the debt you have to get there.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head, which is, I think debt plays an extremely important role in how we all regardless of how much we make, it's created this buffer in America that gives us the false sense that we can afford things that maybe we can't anymore. And so I think, you know, so for instance, you may be really struggling to make ends meet, but at the end of the day, you can afford to splurge to buy that television because you put it on the credit card. And I think, you know, so student debt, mortgage, you know, housing debt, all of these various kinds of debt are skewing our understanding of how much we can really afford. And I actually think because the reason we're even looking at this question about middle classness is to understand inequality. And I think we do ourselves a disservice when we think of inequality as like the very, very rich and the very, very poor and the chasm between. Because what we're not thinking about is all those people who are stuck in the middle, who have maybe like a false sense of being able to maybe hack it, but they're relying on debt. Meanwhile, costs are going up and their wages are stagnating. And so to me, this is a piece of understanding what inequality is and making sure that people understand inequality, but not viewing it just in extremes.
So your organization seeks to ensure economic mobility for all people. How do we get there? What are the important factors that can help really broaden economic security for citizens of Colorado and for citizens of the country as a whole?
Yeah. So we this is a big question. So what you do with big questions, you break it down. So we've broken it down into a few different things. So I think you got to look at it from a couple different perspectives in terms of the forces that are at work. So one force that's at work is demographics. We're getting older. We're getting more diverse. The other force that's at play is technology and the way it's changing work itself and the way our economy is even organized. Public investment, and I'm going to come back to that in a second. We are divesting of all of the public supports that used to exist in this country, or at least in the 20th century, that made the middle class possible. And then I think the last thing to think about is just inequality itself, which is becoming like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think for me, particularly in Colorado is the home of this horrible constitutional advent called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights. And if you want to have a separate podcast about the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, I'd be more than happy to do that. But basically, it puts a huge constriction on the amount of money state government can spend on things like higher education, childcare, education. These are the costs that are going up for families. And these are the things that in America used to be more affordable. You know, just to make this personal, I'm the grandson of a poor Jewish tailor from Eastern Europe, whose son within one generation got into the upper middle class because he got virtually a free education and could become a professional. And this is pretty much the same on my mom's side. Like, that story is not possible anymore because college isn't free. So people are spending more of their income, right, on things that used to be a part of the American social contract. And then wages are just really stagnant. I mean, only now are we getting to the place with wages in America that we were at right before the Great Recession and when you adjust for inflation. So those to me are like the biggest factors, right? Costs are going up. And wages are pretty flat.
Are these things that we can blame Republican administration and Republican legislatures for, or is there something else at play here?
I think you can blame a lot of this on the Koch brothers. I think you can blame a lot of this on conservative libertarian economics that say, you know, get government out of the way, get government out of your pocket, and you're free, but you're free to fail. Like, there's no question that I think this story, because what I love about your podcast is it's like the story of how we got here. This story starts at the end of the 1970s. You know, this begins, I believe, when Nixon goes to China and begins to open up the economy in such a way as to begin to hurt American workers. But then I think it also begins when we start believing this notion that government is trying to control your life. And when we defund government, you can thrive and have more freedom. And it turns out that the people who thrive and have more freedom are the very, very wealthy who are profiting off that economy. But everybody else is getting screwed. But, you know, let's not just blame conservatives, right? Because there's a ton of Democrats who have bought into this sort of neoliberal way of thinking. And so I think there's this, as you know, like there's this debate and argument going on in the Democratic Party right now about how do you define an economy?
Yeah, I will say that, first of all, Scott, it's as if you wanted to catch me and make me record a podcast for 8 hours based on what you just said. I'm at the home of James Buchanan. I teach at Middle Tennessee State University, his alma mater. So for you don't know, he's Buchanan's part of this greater theory of about the way the economy should work that I think you were just referencing, Scott.
Yeah.
Also, the question about universities. I saw in your article that you pointed out that for a parent to pay for 2 years of community college for a child in Colorado, they'd have to save $1,000 a year. However, in Tennessee, we've actually got a plan in place, much to the credit of our governor, that community college is paid for, and he is a Republican. He is as Republican as they come. So, you know, let's follow the good ideas where they come. You know, that's all I wanted to say there.
Yeah, no, and Governor Haslam, you know, I mean, I guess I would disagree that he's as Republican as they come. I mean, I think Governor Haslam is one of these moderates. I think if he was in another state, he'd maybe be a Democrat, but he's in Tennessee. Yeah, I mean, like, but things like free community college, like, I guess for me, it's like, how low should the lowest floor in the American economy be? And like, I think we need to be having that's precisely the right conversation is like, look, community college should be free for everybody in the state, right? Things like that are these like basic guarantees that like we're just not going to let you hit bottom if it's within our power.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price. Which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosechacoffee.com or follow the links at theroadtonow.com.
So you mentioned Nixon and Nixon going to China. Didn't Nixon also want to test out guaranteed minimum incomes? And isn't that being piloted now in Mississippi?
Well, there's a couple of different pilots. There's one out in California. They just stopped doing one out in Ontario, Canada. Yeah, I mean, so like, right. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I never thought about, you know, I don't know enough about why Nixon looked into basic guaranteed income. You know, I think it had a lot to do with he wanted to end the welfare state, right? And he wanted to end public benefits. So it was like this exchange. Like, what if we just cut you a check for $7,000 instead of giving it to you in the form of government programs?
Right. Which is kind of the notion of the pitches I've heard for universal minimum wage that have been pitched is the idea is that if you were to take the money out of the systems that require you to purchase certain things, give people a lump sum of money, then they could actually decide where they wanted to live instead of being placed into communities where poverty is consolidated, or they could decide what to purchase in ways that would give them perhaps more opportunities with their own skill set. What do you think about that?
Oh, I think a lot of things. I mean, I think it is a really interesting concept. So somebody who is really influential in just my career was the former president of SEIU, Service Employees International Union, Andy Stern. And he wrote a whole book about the future of work, but he spends all of his time thinking about basic guaranteed income. Because I think what he's thinking about and what everybody's thinking about is what happens. So now this isn't even about like Nixon and China and globalism, because now we have to start worrying about the robots, right? So we have to worry about robots yeah. And algorithms are coming. And so what happens if like nobody has a job? And so we have to start thinking about this new world in which and it goes back to this thing about like, how do we raise the floor? And that was the title of Stern's book, right? Raising the floor. And so how do we make sure that everybody has at minimum a certain amount of income coming in so that they can withstand the shock of losing their job? And then there's all, you know, but I have questions like, what does that do to inflation? I mean, if everybody has $12,000 How come? Why? Well, maybe landlords will just, everybody will raise their rent by $12,000, right? So I worry about what happens then. But we got to think about that. And then you get into this like super uncomfortable conversation, and I'm not going to take a side other than to say that it's like, it's something we should be thinking about, which is, who does it better? If I give you the money, right, will you be able to make the choices and decisions that will pull you out of poverty and up the economic ladder, versus if government creates a program to help you with healthcare or job training or whatever, which is better? And I suspect it's a blend of the two. And there's studies that suggest that if you put even just an extra $1,000 in somebody's pocket, their kids are going to do that much better, you know, in school, versus just funding education. And that's like a real debate. Like, we almost had that debate on the ballot in Colorado this year. And I think we're going to have it probably in 2020. You know, if we're going to raise taxes, should those taxes go to a, you know, basic guaranteed income kind of thing? Or should they go to make sure that we have better funded classrooms?
So a couple of things that you point out that could improve situations for citizens' economic mobility. One of them is, we'll talk about them. There's two things I want to talk about here, but let's start with wage increases and the minimum wage. You guys recently raised the minimum wage in Colorado. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And it was raised from what to what?
So we went from, I believe it was around $10 an hour to $12 an hour. And it goes up gradually over the course of time. So right now we're up at around $11.
And so what were the arguments against that in the Colorado legislature?
Well, so we couldn't take it through the legislature. And maybe that's something else that we should talk about, that the people will pass things that legislatures just scoff at. But we put it on the ballot. I mean, the arguments were the arguments that we hear all around the country. If you do this, it's just going to raise the prices of things. We're going to be forced to cut jobs. And so even though you think you're helping people, you're actually putting them out of work because you're raising our costs. And what you found here, and you found it in Seattle and all the other places that do it, that those arguments aren't true. That actually you end up putting more money into the economy because you're putting more money into people's pockets, and then they spend that money, and that money gets back into the economy. And so what we found is that there hasn't been huge job loss, and that things are just fine. So those are some of the traditional arguments that we hear, and then we see in like time and time again, it's just not true.
And never mind the fact that if you look at it in real terms, minimum wage in 1968 was like $11 an hour today. It just doesn't, like, at a time when the economy was much better for most working people.
Yeah. Well, and a great example of that is overtime, right? So overtime threshold is like the minimum wage for the middle class, is one way I've heard Nick Hanauer talk about it. And I think that's right. So the federal government sets a threshold and a test that should be applied to determine if you should be paid overtime. And right now the threshold is set at like $27,000 a year. And that's just pathetic, right? And so we're, you know, Obama at the end of his administration tried to raise the threshold to $47,000, which would have just packed it up to inflation. So that's the amount of money. So $27,000 a year is the amount of money once you start making that in salary and you're also deemed a manager, you can no longer make overtime. So we just haven't even raised it to adjust for inflation since the late 70s.
And never mind the fact that we, under the Bush administration, they changed the definitions of what it meant to be a manager so that you could be classified under salary. It used to be you had to have direct control over hiring and firing people, and they loosened the regulations to say, well, you have suggestive control over hiring and firing. And once you do that, assistant managers now, instead of working them 40 hours a week and then having to pay them overtime, you know, if you're a heartless employer, you can turn two or three 40-hour-a-week jobs into two 60-hour-a-week jobs, and you just saved yourself, you know, like $25,000. Sorry.
Yep. Yeah. And think about all the people that affects. I mean, people who work in department stores, people who work in fast food restaurants, people who work on warehouse floors. I mean, it's an entire strata. Here in Colorado, it's like 300,000 people, and we're a state of 5 million people. I mean, 300,000 people would be affected by this change. It's a big deal.
What's the status of the Obama era changes to the Fair Labor and Standards Act?
Well, those got struck down by a court in Texas. And so right now we're in this period where only states can make the change to the overtime threshold. So that's a fight that each state needs to have. And we've seen like Pennsylvania is working on it. I think Washington State's working on it. We'd love it if Colorado could do it, but we know we'll just come up against the same wall of opposition from business that we always do.
So another thing you point out are cost controls. What ways could cost controls help citizens improve their economic mobility? And are you seeing any evidence of that in Colorado?
So I think the cost that we really focus on, and there's a whole other body of work that's just looking at the costs of goods and what market consolidation is doing to the costs of things like drugs and electronics and all those things. I mean, what we look at are the basic services that families struggle with. So childcare. I mean, if there's like any issue that I think the report that we did points to, it's that how important affordable childcare is for any family, but middle class families in this case. So how do you control costs for childcare? I mean, for one thing, we could have healthier public subsidies, right? I think that's something that, you know, right now here in Colorado, only 13% of eligible families have access to CCAP, which is our child care subsidy program. So families who even qualify to get that kind of subsidy don't get it because we just don't have enough money in the program to make sure that everybody has it. So I don't know if that's a cost control as much as that is a subsidy. Another conversation that's happening is around using the tax code. And so you have all these child care and child tax credits. And so Michael Bennett, who's the senator from Colorado, is actually working on a federal bill to expand and increase the child tax credit, right? And this is about more than just economics. This is a social thing. Like we know, and we even saw in our report, but we've seen national data, people are putting off having children. They just realize that either they're going to have to earn more money before they can have a kid, or they're saying, I'm not going to have a kid at all because I can't afford the lifestyle that I want. I mean, that has like huge social implications. And then like, I'll just throw this out to you because I've been thinking about it lately, is like, points out a real interesting irony in conservative, like how can you be like focus on the family, you know, moral conservative and want everybody to have kids, but then support, you know, economic policies that make it harder for people to have kids and that require both earners to work, right? Because that's the other thing is both parents need to be working, which necessitates childcare. And moreover, when you're paying for childcare, you're not saving for college. So I think childcare is like totally at the center of this discussion.
Yeah, just to throw this out there, like my wife and I are both university professors, and we live in Nashville, and the cost of childcare for us is about 10% of our income for a year. 10%.
Wow.
And it's relatively inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean, and those are like your. You know, these are the prime earning years of your life, right? Like this is, and so I think like that 10% of your income is going there. The other thing, oh, and this is the thing that kills me, and we should just all be completely ashamed as a country, what we pay childcare workers. And so that's what's crazy. So everybody needs this. It like defies economic logic. Everybody needs a service. And now the people who provide that service, we're going to pay a pittance. Shouldn't they be in more demand? Shouldn't they be getting paid more? I mean, for an experienced childcare worker in Colorado, the average salary is $30,000 a year. And I think there's a lot of sexism built into that, this notion that, well, the childcare worker's just doing this on the side. That is a huge, huge issue.
There's a lot of racism built into it as well. Because
absolutely.
It has to do with the historic notion that domestic work is associated with Black Americans, and that has a long-term impact on pay.
Ben, you are exactly right. And, you know, being the parent of a special needs child, a lot of the workers that we have been in contact with who work with our daughter, be them therapists or more aides and nursing aides, are getting paid a pittance for work that is physically and emotionally demanding. I mean, this is a this is a profession that these people are in, and they need to be treated like the professionals that they are. And it is absolutely staggering, and it just makes me upset. It makes me upset. I've gotten upset over it a lot over the years.
You know, yesterday, so Bob, just to hit that point even harder, yesterday I was looking at some information, and here in Colorado, home healthcare aides, adjusted for inflation, are making 6% less than they did in 2000. The wages are actually going down, and the long-term care industry is the other side of the equation, right? So you've got childcare on one side, but then you have tremendous demand that is building for long-term care services, for home healthcare aides, personal care aides. But the people we need, so I guess like why this relates back to this issue of the middle class is like, I guess it turns out that the only way we can maintain a middle class lifestyle then in this environment is by cheating people who are necessary to sustain that lifestyle of the money they need to get ahead. And then that fuels this exclusivity. And that's what's dangerous.
So here we are. We're at the very beginning of 2019. The 2020 presidential race is upon us. I think the big issues for, I know, Democrats in particular, one of the big issues is going to be healthcare. I mean, they're going to run on being a check against Trump or getting rid of the swamp, truly draining the swamp this time. But they're also going to run on healthcare because that, they believe, is a winning issue that can bring back the Rust Belt. So being someone who works for a think tank and is knee deep in these economic issues, do you see any candidates that are going to run on the middle class?
Well, that remains to be seen. So Sherrod Brown, I like what's coming out of his mouth. I think that he's, you know, I just listened to him. I mean, this is what he's talking about. Well, and it's interesting. He talks about the working class, right? And the working class and the middle class kind of get confused or associated with each other. And it's like there was a time when being working class meant being middle class. And so, but I think he's talking obviously about what it takes to rebuild the middle class. So I think that's exciting. Bernie Sanders, whether or not he runs or somebody from that movement runs, I think they're going to be talking about middle class issues.
Well, hey, can I interrupt you, Scott? Because there may be a few, at least two people from your state who may run.
So I think John Hickenlooper, who's our governor, is talked about as running for the president of the United States. And we also started to hear about Michael Bennett, who actually worked for John Hickenlooper in a different stage in his career, maybe also running for president. I mean, I think, you know, both of these candidates need to figure out their challenge is how do you talk about these issues without, you know, here in Colorado, we've built this very, this political environment where everybody wants to get along and we really want to, you know, collaborate with each other and unify. But the challenge is how do you talk about these issues? Because at the end of the day, we're not distributing resources adequately in this economy. Like somebody's making too much money and we've got to figure out how to redistribute some of this money in a way where everybody prospers and everyone thrives. And so I think the challenge that both John Hickenlooper and Michael Bennett have is, you know, at some point you got to gore somebody's ox. We've got to put limits on the amount of money that people are able to make in this economy. And we've got to make sure that we raise the floor. So I just think that it's a unique challenge in Colorado that we've had this very collaborative spirit, but at some point we've got to have a fight and we've got to say, no, we're going to cap that deduction. No, we're going to make sure we're going to raise taxes and we're going to do it in a progressive way. So I think both those candidates and any, you know, this is the problem that Hillary Clinton had. Maybe we got to have a fight. It doesn't mean we have to be mean and nasty, but that's what Donald Trump showed. I mean, unfortunately, Donald Trump the one thing he got right was that there is inequality in this economy and there are winners and losers. Everything else he got wrong. But I think that's the challenge that both Bennett and Hickenlooper will have.
Hickenlooper 2020. Did I just say that? Hickenlooper 2020. Did I just say that again? All I'm saying is, John Hickenlooper, if you're listening, I will knock on doors for you. Anyway,
think? Knock on doors for John Hickenlooper if he talks about these issues.
Yeah. Well, it remains to be seen. I don't want to get ahead of myself. My tail started wagging. Anyway.
Well, Ben, you got to, and I love Governor Hickenlooper as well, but I got to say, pretty much the only three people that aren't running for president are the three of us having a conversation right now. Everyone is going to be running. It's going to be.
I was planning an announcement on this call, but
it's a field of thousands. So it's we got a ways to go.
Yeah, I will say this though, like getting back to the discussion about middle class versus working class, I think that middle class. It's everybody, right? Even poor folks are like, I'm lower middle class, and super wealthy people are like, I'm upper middle class. But like, doesn't working class evoke something that makes more sense? Like the idea that I go to work to make my money, that I don't have an investment fund or don't have a trust fund or you know, I don't make money off of other people working or I don't sit back. Like I'm a person that goes to work. And doesn't that evoke like a sense of empathy and solidarity amongst the group of people, like in a way that's more useful than middle class?
Well, that's what I was talking about earlier, is that I think there was a period of time in America between the end of World War II and, let's just say, for argument's sake, like the end of the 1970s, in which working class and middle class kind of meant the same thing. That if we've all heard like the trite phrase, like if you work hard, play by the rules, you could get a middle class life. I think what's happened over the last 30 years is a parting of ways between the working class and the middle class. And now when we think of the working class, we think of, you know, blue collar jobs, people who stand, you know, there's like interesting little wedges, you know, between us, the people who stand up all day and the people who sit down all day, you know, the professional versus the blue collar. And somebody, I forget who it was, and I feel bad for not attributing this to them, is like right after the election, they were like, you know why people hated Hillary Clinton? People hated Hillary Clinton because she was a symbol of professionalism. She was a lawyer. There's this perception that, you know, the professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, they don't work with their hands, right? And actually, if you look at our study, I mean, the people who today have a greater likelihood of getting into the middle class are the professionals, the people who went to college, the people who don't work with their hands. So, I mean, that just saddens me because, you know, that's the greatest crime of all. And so I think working class versus middle class has become a divide that needs to be addressed.
Ben, any further questions for our astute, intelligent, and kind, generous guest?
Further questions? It's now a scroll. I have to unfurl the scroll. We'll have to get back to this. I have a scroll of also student papers that are awaiting my attention.
I'd like to point out that Scott keeps alluding to this period between the end of World War II and the end of the 1970s that. A recent and former guest of ours, Jefferson Cowie, has built a career on defining.
Great exception?
The great exception. This period, I don't know if you're familiar with economic historian Jefferson Cowie from Vanderbilt, formerly of Cornell, but he's written several books about a period that he calls the great exception.
That's what worries me the most. What if the like peak period that we all keep referencing was just like an exception? What if it's not repeatable because it was just one moment in time that can't be reproduced?
But that is the surge of wealth is that it is extraneous. It is not a function of the system itself, but you can't lose your focus on the fact that surges of wealth will happen again. The difference in that era was that there was a mechanism for ensuring that there was a way for people who were working to share in the pie.
Amen.
And with the destruction of unions and with the destruction of any sense of obligation to one another, the destruction of funding for universities, all the things that were there that really played a role in ensuring that the people at the bottom got a share of that wealth, they've been broken down.
Yep.
So even if another moment comes, there are plenty of moments of economic growth. Even if another moment comes, what's there to make sure that all of us get to benefit from it? I'm worried that they might not be there.
Could we do a second podcast on that, on just that? Because there's a lot to say about that.
I would love to. I'll come to Colorado this summer.
Awesome.
All right, Scott. A friend of Max Potter's is a friend of mine.
Likewise.
Oh, Max Potter's great.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated the opportunity to chat with you guys. It was a lot of fun.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. Hello, Road to Now listener. Seems that by being here means that you like to get information by listening to it. You might be listening right now in your car, while you're driving, maybe you're mowing your grass, maybe you're just sitting in a room by yourself staring at a wall. In any case, you're learning by listening. I like to do the same thing, which is why a couple weeks ago, I went looking for a new audiobook company and I came across Libro.fm. Libro.fm is an audiobook company which allows you to purchase your audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers, recommendations for bookstores around the country, and also a playlist curated by The Road to Now featuring our past guests. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobook at the same price as the other audiobook companies, whatever they are, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. All you need is a smartphone and the free Libro.fm app. If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to, check out recommendations from our podcast featuring guests including Jefferson Cowie, Douglas Brinkley. There's so many of them. You can go check it out. I made the playlist myself, and I'm really proud to do this. The best part about Libro .fm is that you literally are sponsoring your local bookstore. And if you're anything like me, you really like your local bookstore, but sometimes you want audiobooks. Well, here is the solution to the problem. Road to Now listeners can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month. That means for just $15, you can sign up and you'll get 3 months with one free book. And if you're anything like me, you're going to download a giant biography of like Grant or something and listen to it over the course of a month. It's all the same price. $15 a month. How do you get that? All you have to do is go to Libro.fm. That's Libro.fm, and enter the promo code RTN at the top of the page. And they also have gifts. You can buy a gift for somebody if you're looking for that special holiday gift. Give them the gift of knowledge. Just go to Libro.fm, enter the promo code RTN, and we thank you for listening. Today's episode is edited by Gary Fletcher. Today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, Jeff LeCain, and Linda Thamer. If you'd like to join us on Patreon and get extra content, go to roadtonow.com and click on support at the top of our page. Keep up with us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at @road_2_now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and a 5-star rating and a few kind words does a lot to help us get the word out. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care. Osiris.